Good afternoon. We'd like to welcome everyone to this afternoon's study session from Mesa City Council for Monday, May 2nd, 2011. And Ms. Zelanka, I'm back.
So this is going to go a lot longer.
Okay. The first item on the agenda is to review the agenda for tonight's regular council meeting. Items 3A through 3C.
All in.
3D through 3G. Three H through three J, three K through three M, four A through six A, six B through nine E, nine F through ten B. Mr. Brady, you want to go through that on 10A?
Yes.
For item 10?
Yeah, item 10. Council has in their packet, but just kind of briefly go over the presentation regarding the proposed changes. Just a slight modification after you all did the survey from what we talked about with the council during your presentation. Is that correct, Mike?
Well, actually, we did get an alternative recommendation from the TAB, but we're not recommending that.
Oh, okay.
What we're recommending is what we presented with our budget presentation a couple weeks ago.
Okay, can you go through that for the council?
Absolutely. Here you can see our existing buzz route. As you know, it currently runs clockwise and counterclockwise every half an hour, serving the downtown area along University, Alma School, 8th Street, Date, Brown Center, and then down into the downtown area. To meet our target reduction, we have suggested a modification. Well, where we're running almost, it's a new route that still maintains service, where we have current service today, but it's more of a line with a one-way loops at each end. And you can see it starts at the senior center at third place, comes down to first and center where you can connect to the library and the post office. Goes back up Center Street to Brown, serves the Brown Corridor, Date, and then does a one-way loop on the east side of Westwood down to University where you can connect to the Fry's and the grocery stores, and then does a one-way loop back to downtown. We've also added some additional trips to the Mesa Drive and Brown intersection. We've heard over the last 2 years a lot of people would like to make that connection over to the Walgreens, Osco, CVS, Bash's for shopping in that area. So we anticipate some mid-morning three trips at least to serve that intersection for some additional shopping opportunities. So we had basically two opportunities for outreach. We went to our Transportation Advisory Board. We did hear a comment about the concern of loss for this bus service on University for low-income riders. There are some concerns about the number of riders from the high school there using the system, and we also heard that from the public at large. But when we actually looked at that and evaluated, we don't achieve the cost savings, and we don't think it works as well to get to the destinations that you need. So we're sticking to our original recommendation. Going back to the public outreach, we spent 4 hours last Tuesday and Wednesday out at the Mesa Active Adult Center, formerly known as the Mesa Senior Center. We talked to about 35 people during those 2 days. We've got a handful of surveys. Basically, what I would say is a quarter of the people had some concerns it wasn't going to be quite as good as the existing service, but the remainder of the people felt that they could still get to their destinations, understanding that they may have to transfer or it'd be a little bit different service. So that was really the summary of our findings.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? All right, thank you. Okay, there's nothing else on the agenda. Moving to the next item. hear a presentation and discuss the city council redistricting process.
Good afternoon, Mayor Smith and council members. I'm Carla Wagner with the City Manager's Office, and I have with me today Douglas Johnson from National Demographics Corporation. We are here to give you a presentation on the redistricting process based on the recent 2010 census. The initiative to move the city of Mesa to council district system was approved in 1998, and the districts were first established in 1999, and then we went through a redistricting process in 2001. It's now time to go through this process again as a result of the 2010 census. The city charter requires that the district boundaries be established by a 5-person nonpartisan commission appointed by the city council. And the charter also requires that the city council approve the commission's recommendation, or if disapproved, send the recommendations back to the commission for reconsideration. And then the second recommendation from the commission shall be deemed final. The consultant that we have selected to help us with this process is National Demographics Corporation, and this is the same consultant that assisted us in 1999 as well as 2001. As the City Council knows, a few weeks ago they did appoint the Redistricting Commission, and we are scheduled to have our first meeting May 12th at 6 p.m. here in the lower council chambers. The next several slides just kind of goes over a high-level timeline of our process, and basically the district commission will have meetings and we will be coming back periodically to the council to provide updates, and we will be scheduling some public hearings, one in each district, to seek input from our citizens. So we are anticipating that the process starts now in May, and it will continue through the summer with anticipation that we will submit our submission to the Department of Justice the first part of November 2011. This next slide just compares our 2000 census to our 2010 census. And so the first column, as you see, our population was 397,760 with our ideal population of 66,293. If you look at those districts 1 through 6, that's what the population was after we had done our redistricting in 2001. Moving over to our 2010 census, our population, total population number is 439,041, with the ideal population being 73,174. As you can kind of go through those districts, you can see where the most of our growth has been in districts 5 and 6. And so this is kind of where we're at today, and I'm going to turn the time over to Doug Johnson from National Demographics to talk more about the process.
Good afternoon, and it is a pleasure to be working with the city once again. Just a little background, my name is Doug Johnson, and I actually started with NDC back in the 91 redistricting cycle, and then in 2001 came back just at the tail end of your work. So I worked somewhat on Mesa's preclearance, and you may remember Alan Heslop and Florence Adams, who worked with you back in that round. And you may see them at some of the forums through this process as well. Going to walk through this fairly quickly, keep it high level. If you have questions, I'm happy to discuss them in more detail about any of these slides in here. As was just mentioned, your population has grown essentially 10% over the last decade, and obviously the growth has been uneven across the city, which is why we need to rebalance the districts. The just high level demographics, you're looking at in terms of total population. Latinos are now 26.4% of the city. Non-Hispanic whites are just under two-thirds at 64%. And then all the other ethnic and racial groups are at 9%. When we go through this process, we also look at total population to make sure it's one person, one vote, and that the districts are balanced. And then we also look at the Voting Rights Act side of this. That gets into a couple of other categories, what we call voting age population, which is the next one, citizen voting age population, which is a new data set that comes out from the Census Bureau, but it's not from the decennial census. And then there's a chance that we'll be getting from the state Hispanic surname voter registration. So what we look at in Voting Rights Act is the Latino power to elect the candidates of their choice, is the legal term of art. And ideally, you'd be looking at voters for that. And ideally, you'd have voting voter ethnicity data that was just as accurate as the census. We don't live in an ideal world. So the census has a nice door-to-door count, but is somewhat removed from voting. While at the other end, the voting data, obviously, surname data has its weaknesses of marriage and all of that. So we use all these data as a to get a full rounded picture of the city and the demographics as we move forward in this process. This slide is similar to what you just looked at. Essentially, what it comes down to is the courts like to have jurisdictions within 10% total plan deviation at the most. That's an extreme that they will allow only under certain circumstances. Your current deviation is about 64%, the difference between the largest district at 45% and the smallest district at almost 20% under works out to 65%. So that's why the city needs to go through this process now to bring that down to certainly below 10% and hopefully essentially zero. And this is just a graphical map showing that the growth, you know, no surprise to any of you, the growth has been on the east side of town. So what we'll see in this process is districts 5 and 6 shrink in geographic territory as they give up population, and the four more western districts all will have to expand to pick up people. The other piece I might note, too, for example, District 2 is just under at 8%. For Mesa, relatively close to balance. The challenge is that it's in the middle. So while its numbers may not in a table look like it needs much change, all that population for Districts 3 and 4 and possibly some population for 1 will have to pass through District 2. So even it will see significant shifting in this process. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the next couple slides, but I talked about the different data categories we go to. This is an example of first the counts, and then next slide, the percentages. At the top is a box showing total population. The second row is a voting age population, or 18 plus. And then at the bottom are the two different census tabulations of citizen voting age population. So these are the sheets that we'll give out for every plan that goes through this process. So mainly in Mesa, we're focusing on total population and on Latinos. But if there are people who are interested in the other categories, the data is here and available. So how will we address these districts? Well, there are what are called the traditional redistricting criteria. These are ones that the discussion tends to focus the most on. The main one is communities of interest. And that's why we'll be engaging the committee and the public in this process, is to identify the neighborhoods that really are I describe them as the puzzle pieces that we need to identify, and then later on we figure out how those pieces fit together into districts. Then we like the districts to follow visible, natural, and man-made boundaries, things like freeways, rivers, other clear barriers that make it easy for the voters to understand which district they live in when they're trying to get engaged in the politics of the city and get involved. Compactness and contiguity are important for the same reason. It's a lot easier to engage your neighbors in discussion if you can say the district goes from the freeway to the city border than if you have to say, well, it goes up 3rd Street and over 4th Street and weaves around like that. Continuity in office, and that's a traditional criteria where essentially you avoid pairing incumbents so the voters don't lose somebody that they voted for in the past. And I'll talk in a minute about, you have a specific charter provision here in Mesa that makes it even more strict. Population growth, you may remember from 10 years ago and from the original districting. If there's a known development that we know people are going to be moving into in the next year or two, and it's a lot of people, sometimes we'll underpopulate that district. It was a very common thing to do in Arizona 10 years ago. Now, given the housing market, there's a lot more ifs about housing, and it's a lot more questions about it. So we tend to recommend not doing that just because you'd be taking into account something that may not happen. But it is a criteria that the committee may choose to look at. And then preserve the core of existing districts is the last one. It's hard to do in a jurisdiction that's had as much growth as Mesa has. As you've seen, there's going to be a lot of shifting. But it is something that the courts have said is an acceptable traditional criteria. It's just mainly for the voters that are comfortable. They've always known they're in District 3. They'd like to stay and keep voting in District 3. So those are the traditional criteria that can all be balanced against each other. Overriding all of that, of course, is the federal laws. First of all is equal population. We've talked about that already. The Voting Rights Act that I'll breeze through a little bit and we'll spend much more time on with the committee. And then there is an Arizona statute its application to Mesa is somewhat in doubt because you have your own charter. But it is out there, just so you know about it, that says essentially the districts need to be equal in population and compact. As I mentioned, you have your own charter provision. This both creates the commission and gives it the ultimate say on where the lines go. And it also says, however, that no incumbent should be removed from a district. So in order to comply with the charter, we may end up with some slightly unusual lines that may not be as compact or anything like that. But again, this is a law. The others are just the traditional criteria.
Let me ask you a question. Sure. Our charter is silent as to the state statute as far as being contiguous territory and compact. Even though we're a charter, if our charter is silent, does the state law then act as a filler for that? Or is that sort of a gray area? Or am I asking something?
I'll defer to city attorney unless I can get...
Mayor, I think we will obviously try and read them together and accomplish both. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to have to take into consideration all of the criteria and not say this one trumps every other one. So right. I think what the consultant's going to try and do is meld them all together and see what level of compactness can we reach. So we'll still strive for that, but it may have to give way with regard to the charter provision.
Yeah, I would guess that since federal law supersedes that and acts as filler and would even supersede what we do as a charter, but our charter is written to accomplish two or three basic mm-hmm. things, such as not districting out an incumbent, stuff like that. That it seems like they would all work together, that would still need to take that into account.
That will be the goal.
Okay.
It's somewhat gray, and let's hope we can stay away from stepping into the gray as we draw these plans. It's the safest approach. So, for those of you that went through this process, Mr. Kavanaugh, or observed this process 10 years ago, there are a lot of things that have changed. 10 years ago, if you were within 10% in plan deviation, you were safe. You were presumed legal. You still have the advantage in a court challenge, but the old safe harbor is gone. There was a case out of Georgia where the court said you can still deviate up to 10%, but it has to be for a specific reason. In our final plan, we have to say here's a deviation of 2% to keep this neighborhood together. Here's a deviation of 3%. In order to follow the freeway rather than cut through a neighborhood. So the simple safe harbor, once you're under 10%, you're fine, is gone, and we will work with the commission on getting that to zero, except where we can cite a specific reason. There was the Texas case that redefined communities of interest, essentially said that you can't string two neighborhoods that are at separate ends of the jurisdiction together, even if they may have similar interests. Specifically, that case was a Latino community down on the Gulf and a Latino community 200 miles inland. They were similar in demographics, but they were 200 miles apart. So the claim that they were a united community of interest fell apart, which was a bit of a change. And then there was a Bartlett v. Strickland case, which said that the Voting Rights Act doesn't really kick in. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act doesn't really kick in until a protected class population gets to majority status. Doesn't really apply here, given the population numbers here. And then Namundo versus Holder, there's some buzz about this, as in particular counties are starting to look at trying to bail out. Mesa could bail out or could apply for bailout, but I think it's unlikely that anyone in Arizona will be going through that anytime soon. But it is a big change from 10 years ago.
That's a bailout of the Voting Act. The voter
of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. And there are a couple jurisdictions going through that process now, one in California, a couple in the South. So we'll see how the first post-Namundo bailout applications go, and then I think there'll be a lot more interest once people see the roadmap. There were some changes to the Voting Rights Act mid-decade and changed some of the rules from 2001. The biggest change, however, is the really new Department of Justice regulations. It's very clear that the Department of Justice is going to be more rigorous in their review of everyone's applications this time around. So we've been working with the city staff on an outreach plan and an engagement plan and making sure that we do everything we can to ensure that we have our best shot at preclearance possible. Let me briefly go through these. Essentially, Section 2, as I mentioned, it has less efficacy in Mesa now after the Bartlett decision. But it says that if there's a protected class population, which there's a long legal definition of that, but in Mesa it comes down to Latinos, says if there is a concentration, you should neither pack that population by cramming every one of them into a district, even if they aren't in the same neighborhoods, and you should also not crack those neighborhoods. So packing and cracking is what it comes down to, and we'll guide you and the commission through this process to make sure that we don't go anywhere near that. At the same time, you're not allowed to string together every census block just because it came up in the census with Latino numbers. Everything needs to be based on neighborhoods and communities. And then Section 5, you probably remember, this is the retrogression. And this is a challenge in high-growth communities where the growth may not be in the Latino community. So we'll look at these numbers and see what can be done to ensure that the Latino voting power is just as strong after redistricting as it is today. That's really what it comes down to. And if it's not possible on a simple mathematical numbers basis, we have to do everything possible we can to stay as close as we can. So again, this is really our responsibility and legal counsel to guide this through the process and make sure that all the plans that the committee considers are comply with these. So let me briefly go through the process, and again, we'll do this in a lot of detail with the committee. First is the initial demographic analysis, those spreadsheets that you saw earlier in the PowerPoint. That really sets the baseline for where do we have to go. Then we'll look at the schedule. As you saw, we have the draft schedule, and we'll nail down those dates and launch all the information on the public and try to start getting the public engaged. We are looking at participation kits. You may remember from last time, these are kind of our specialty. They're really kits that have the census data and a paper map so that anyone can sit at home on their kitchen table and draw a plan. It's a lot of work. But this process does engage the public, and people kind of, they really have the chance here to not just say yes or no, but if there's something they don't like, to try their hand at making it better. And we, in about the middle of the decade, started using an Excel table for that. For people that are comfortable in Excel, they can just type it in, and Excel automatically totals everything for them. And now, this time around, we're looking at doing an online redistricting solution, where people will actually be able to draw plans right from their internet browser. We're talking about through the summer when a lot of people leave town, we'll get them the information, and from San Diego they can be drawing plans that we can discuss when they get back. So our real trademark is engaging the public, and we'll be using all these tools to really make sure that the community feels a part of this process. It really is a chance to not just say no, but to say how you would do something differently, to really for the people to put themselves in your chairs for a moment. And one thing that often comes out of that is people saying, wow, this is hard. So, I mentioned we're going to do extensive outreach to try to get the public engaged and tell them about these opportunities. We want the public to come in and draw plans if they feel like it. If not, just to identify their neighborhoods. Is their neighborhood defined by the park? Is their neighborhood defined by the local school? We want to figure out these pieces so that we're careful and we respect all the neighborhoods of the city when these plans come together. And then, obviously, our goal is to make pieces that are smaller than a district. So which pieces make sense to go together, and which pieces may not have similar interests. The most common one is usually they rename themselves the active adult community versus a neighborhood that has lots of kids. Two very different communities with different interests. And, you know, one council member trying to represent both may feel overwhelmed or torn. So sometimes they, especially if he's twice as many people as anyone else in his district. And so often they will say, you know, it probably makes sense that we be with other active adult communities, or we be with other communities that have lots of kids so that they can have a shared voice. And that's what we want to hear from the public. There's no right answer there. It's what the neighborhoods think. And then, of course, decision. But this, the vote on the plan by the committee and by the council and possibly back to the committee is not the final step. As we mentioned, there is, in, for all Arizona jurisdictions, Section 5 review that hopefully will breeze through. And then implementation. One thing that is often overlooked is we have to carefully coordinate with the elections office to make sure the districts go in the way that they were drawn and that the next elections are conducted as we plan. It's amazing what can happen when computer files start going back and forth. So we will follow up on all those steps. I talked a little bit about this. You've already seen the tools. Let's get more to the new stuff. You may know from the census that the long form is no more. The old long questionnaire was not part of this census. It's been replaced by something called the American Community Survey. This is a survey of 250,000 households every quarter, a million households a year, that really replaces the long form. It's not quite as detailed and accurate as the long form. There's not as many as the long form used to go to, but it is available now. 10 years ago, the long form data wasn't available until 2003 and 2004. This we have in hand now. So now we have income data. We have citizenship data. We have language spoken at home data. All these pieces are now available for use in defining communities. And the other flip is that 10 years ago, the census GIS map was invaluable. Thank goodness they put it out. Now your local GIS is much better and more accurate than the Census Bureau. So now we have zoning, we have parcels, we have homeowner associations. All these things will be available for people to reference. And most of all, we have the online system. And we'll actually put the plans up in Google Maps. So people that actually just want to look at the lines, they don't want to draw, but they just want to see where they are and comment on them, can do it just as easily as they get directions to their friend's house. And if you haven't used Google Earth, it's a free download that's awesome, and it takes everything 3D. You can zoom in and really see the geography of the city. So that is a quick breeze through this process. We, as I mentioned, we'll go through this in even more detail with the committee and take a little more time with them to get them into, oriented as to what faces them. But happy answering questions.
Councilmember Higgins.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. There was a chart way back, I don't know, and it talked about citizens of voting age population.
Yes.
Do you? There's no way you don't weigh that against real numbers, because, like, when you just look at that, you know, we'll just pick District 4 has half citizens of voting age and someone else, but you would still end up with a district with people, right? Just even
right.
though half of them, or there are way less people available to vote there, that doesn't seem fair to them.
It is. It's the dynamics of how the courts have decided this. And
okay.
The nice thing from my perspective is the policy question's there, but the courts have said do it this way. So in terms of equal population, that is done purely on total population. So if you have different rates of citizenship and voter registration and voter turnout, when all the districts are equal in population, you will get very different numbers of citizens of voting age and voters. The example I always say is in Congress, there's one congressman who, to win his seat, needs 250,000 votes. There's another one who only needs about 35,000 votes. It's, you know, the debate can certainly be held as to what's the right approach. And the simple approach for this is the courts have said do it this way.
Any other questions? We'd like to thank you for being the first person since I've taken office that uses the word retrogression 3 times during the presentation.
But Kathy, not a single acronym.
This is, well, he didn't say it, but there's a lot in here, but that's all right.
But he didn't say it.
Luckily, I had my online dictionary ready, but go ahead.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. No more questions? Thanks so much. Look forward to this interesting process.
It's good to be back in Mesa.
Welcome back. Good. Okay, the next item on the agenda is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on transaction, privilege tax, fees/replacement.
of the current tax and licensing system. We're not going to get any retrogression on this one, are we?
I can't.
We can only hope that we retrogress.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Council. My name is Tim Meyer. I'm the Licensing and Revenue Collections Administrator. I'm here today to discuss our proposal to update our current tax system. Updating the system will make it a lot easier for our businesses in Mesa by updating many of the manual processes that we have today. The current process that we currently go through right now is a very manual process. If someone wants to get a tax license, TPT license in the city of Mesa, you need to do it either in person, through the mail, or through a fax machine. There's no online capabilities. There's no way to do anything through the internet. So everything's a very manual process. From the licensing process to the tax form submission, all of that is a very manual process. So what we're here today is to discuss our proposal to update our system and our proposed funding solution to do that. Along with that, we can go ahead and start with our first slide.
The current system that we have today,
I don't think that's on.
There it is.
Yeah.
I think it's on now.
Named Comet. It's not one of the reindeers, but it's a homegrown system, again, that we tend to do here. It's over 18 years old. Last significant update was about approximately 3 years ago. The system is running. It's doing its job, but it's really beyond its useful life. It really supports the business, as Tim has said, 24,000 licenses in there today, and revenue up to $155 million of revenue passes through that system on an annual basis. There's also specialty licenses, such as massage parlors and other things, are managed and tracked in that system today. From a risk perspective, the system will keep on running and limping along as best we can. The software that supports it is out of date, no longer supported by the manufacturers. So it's not imminently in risk of imploding upon itself, but we can't do anything with it. If the risk is to do anything to this system could cause us to have it go down and not function again. So we really don't want to touch it if we can avoid it. There's no enhancement capability, as I said, in the system as it exists today. It really is frozen in time for the moment. There's no web functionality. As Tim said, all the processes are manual, basically, right now. It's paper forms in and out. No web interfaces, no online payment of taxes, no online registrations, no online renewals or updates. We had looked at potentially bundling this together with the CityEdge project. We knew we were going to be updating a lot of our business systems. And when we went out and surveyed the vendors that provide the CityEdge kind of systems don't do the tax and license systems. The best of breed vendors have created solutions that just target these tax and license issues. So what we're really talking about is a best of breed solution to help us move the city forward. An update to the system would really simplify the business processes. It would allow us to really web enable all the applications, electronic filing and payments. The data entry would be greatly reduced. We would capture the information electronically through optical character recognition. When forms came in, even if they sent in paper forms, we would still be able to capture the information input into our databases, so there would be less error along the way. Benefits to the city, again, would be, on the business side, just for the tax and licensing perspective, auditing, case management, and enforcement, reducing and reducing manual processes across the board. And we really want to streamline the public's interaction with the city. I think we've got some good options that we'll talk about in a little bit. I think we're one of the few cities in the valley that doesn't have a system like this. There are seven other cities in the valley that have these types of systems online today and functioning. A number of councils have asked us to look at this option and how we can simplify doing businesses, and we think we have some options to do that. And it got some iMesa votes, Mayor. It wasn't number one, but it was on the iMesa docket.
And how many of those 16 votes actually work for the tax collection? Anonymous.
That's right.
Okay.
we could add more.
Even if they didn't, I appreciate the fact they use the iMesa platform, which is web-based and web-oriented.
Absolutely. The comments were, you know, why don't we have this? No brainer, let's do this. So you can go look through the comments, and they were not, as far as I know, by any means.
You seem to be very familiar with the comments, Alex.
Just move on.
Yep. Can't say that.
Plow through.
You going anywhere on another business trip somewhere?
Suddenly it's quiet.
One of the things we've been asked to look at was a one-stop shop. Can we potentially consolidate some of our other license programs into this initiative? And we really believe we can from some perspective. There are really two other systems we're looking at. So we believe we can, through this program, consolidate the license input and issuance in this software and system we're looking to talk about today.
So you're talking about the difference. You know, you talked about the specialty licenses and the base sales tax license for.
That's what the system does out of the box, and what we believe we can add to that functionality as we move forward is the two other major licensing issues we talked about. One of them being the fire safety operational permits, and the other one is the alarm permitting process.
So you're thinking that if we upgraded that new system, we'd be able to integrate those in the software?
There are two pieces to those systems. One of them is the citizen-facing or the business-facing focus, where they interface when they get a new permit or they have to do a renewal or they have to pay their fees and charges. This new system we're proposing, we believe, can do those pieces. Now, on the back end, for example, on the fire safety permitting piece, the fire uses a program called Firehouse. Again, that's one of their best of breeds. It covers a number of functions. But what it does on the back end that this system won't do is it actually steps them through the inspection process. So it gives them the checklists, the things they need to do when they're doing the inspections. That's how they record the inspections, not the permitting side of it, but how they do the business side of it on the back end. That will stay where it is in Firehouse, but the front-end piece that touches the citizens and business would be in this new integrated system. The same thing with the alarm permitting process. When an alarm comes in, our PD gets the call through the 911 center, typically, or through a phone call from an alarm company. That will stay there in the 911 system and through the current police system. But how we license those things will stay in the new system we're proposing. That makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, they're just database-driven anyway. So what you're saying is that if someone renews their alarm license, it would dump down and would show up on the police that they are currently licensed. That's the only information they really need from that standpoint. Now, do we charge an excess alarm?
There's a tiered system of
system?
Of depending on how many alarms they get that they respond.
Okay, so that's a backside operation.
That's a backside operation that would still remain where it is today in the CAD, the computer dispatch and records management system that BD currently manages.
Okay, Councilmember Higgins.
Does any of that, the PD and the fire, is that somebody in the fire department doing that right now that takes that form, or does it always go through the tax and licensing department now?
Today?
Yep. Yes.
It goes through fire.
So, like, the form you fill out for your renewal of your alarm goes to fire. Now it's going to be going automatic through you?
In theory, just to your point, yeah. Councilman, today if you needed to pick up your fire permit, your sales tax permit, and your PD, how many different counters would you have to go to?
Three different counters and fill out basically the same information three different times?
So and three different buildings.
Yes.
Well, you hope it's the same information.
Well, pretty close.
Yeah.
Pretty close. Well, yes. That information is the same.
So now we're going online and filling out those three forms. It all goes through. I'm assuming.
Alex, what or Jim?
Sure. Yeah.
If we were to be able to integrate all three of these and get our sales tax online, I'm not familiar whether PD and fire are online or not. But would all this be online, and would it be essentially going to one side or one location to process those?
The licensing side would all be done through the new system we're proposing, and then it would feed the operational systems in the back end. So when a license was established, it would, again, feed Firehouse, the system, and Fire would now know that there is a business that they have to inspect, and they would use their Firehouse system to manage the inspections. And the similar police – they would now know through their records management system that there's an active alarm permit at this location. And when they received the call, they would look it up in their database and say, yeah, that we have a permit, that we don't have to charge them for not having an alarm permit and so forth, and start tracking violations and alarm call-outs.
So the only thing that's different is there's nobody really at PD or fire filling, processing a form anymore. It's all going through the online system.
Business owner would do it themselves online if they chose to do that. We'd steer them towards the online system.
They could still fill out something in paper and submit it, but there would be one submittal.
But it would be through the customer.
And there would be a box to check, I'm paying this fee and this fee. However it be, those would be consolidated, and the business really would be like a one-stop shop.
Yes.
Oh. I got that from somewhere. So that's what you're saying we could accomplish. How confident are you that that can...
The systems we're talking about are highly configurable. We need to set up the business rules. We need to have
fire. We've got retrogression and configural now. Okay.
Customizable, is that a better one? But
that's
worse also. But what we need is we need to get business services and fire and police to sit down together and jointly work up the requirements for all these things, and we could do that.
But you're coming from a technological standpoint that's doable.
Yes.
It's just, okay. Councilmember Finter.
This is great. You know what's interesting is to be on a committee and watch the evolution of these projects when they finally get to council. I could have swore in our committee meetings that I was told five different ways from not that these systems wouldn't work, that we couldn't, the fire wouldn't, the PD wouldn't. We had everybody here and everybody said that wouldn't work. So this is an amazing positive revelation that now they will work together on a one-stop shop, because I distinctly heard that even if we went with this, we couldn't make it a one-stop shop. But I'm glad we're getting to that point, and you know, see how this thing grows. But
Councilmember, if I may, if that came out that way, it was because those other two systems, the alarm permit and the firehouse, need to be going in the background to be doing those other activities. Right. Uh-huh. But the actual interface with the citizen should be able to be done through a tax system.
Well, I mean, they're just relational. I can't remember the word. Databases. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're just dumping fields into different programs, right?
So, Councilmember, maybe the answer to the question is we can do the front end together with the information, and maybe staff better should have explained.
Well,
we can collect the information that everybody needs on the front end, but it can't do the tax software can't do the CAD development that PD and fire need, and then maybe if we erred in that, we shouldn't
the
have
CAD development.
Well, what happens is the information that comes from the alarm system then goes to PD, so they know the location of those alarms.
Right.
But why do we care about that? No, I mean, not us.
Right.
All we care about is making. Isn't our objective to make this easy for businesses?
Yes.
Information gets into the system,
what
the
I'm concerned about is the council member, and I don't disagree with him, because I think a lot of good questions were asked. When the initial answer to the question, can you consolidate all these, if the answer may have been given that that's not possible, and I think what he's hearing today is it is possible to collect all the front-end information on the application for the license, but even the tax license software by itself won't perform all the notifications and the back-end operations that's needed. So I don't know if I was there at that meeting. If we erred in giving that impression, I think now that Alex has been able to look at the configuration and ITD is being able to figure out that the software would be able to configure with our current software we have for Firehouse and the current operation software we have for PD, we can collect all the information online from the businesses, Alex, correct?
Yes.
And yet still create the back-end operations functionality that the inspectors need for the fire department, as well as how we need to manage the alarm system. Is that
well? In reality, the only difference is that right now, someone walks in, they fill out a paper, and someone key punches it in, right?
Correct.
Key punches that base information: name, address, other information. Mm-hmm. The only difference is what we're saying is they either go online or they have another submittal that's entered in once, and wherever it's entered in, that data populates the three different programs. So you don't have to enter those separately.
Right.
Once it gets in those programs, I think we understand that there's three completely separate functions that operate.
Yeah, but to Councilmember Fincher's point is the committee raised the point, and I think it was a very valid point, that we've now maybe been able to come up with a better answer is, can we take, we presented one option. How can we prevent the sales tax system updated so that it is more business friendly and simplified? And I think then the challenge was given to staff, what about expanding that to all interactions with businesses, which in this case would include fire and PD? I think now we have hopefully the better answer that we can do it, yet still provide that. We'll still maintain firehouse, we'll still maintain the PD, but they'll be in the background from what the business owner sees. Is that correct?
It's what we're, again, doing with CityEdge is one version of the data that all the systems would share. So you enter it once and then share it amongst the other business systems. And that's the goal.
Can I follow up?
Yeah.
So the challenge, one of the questions were answered or asked at the committee level, and it's a little bit of frustration, is when we had CityEdge brought through, it's a $17 million price tag. And, it, you know, I think a few of us gulped hard when we go, wow, that's a lot of money, but it handles the financial portion of it. What has been clarified since is, even though this is one of the biggest revenue-generating systems that come into the financial system, as you explained, it doesn't cover that. But it kind of feels like when you go to buy a Cadillac, and then when you get to the paying time, it's a 20% increase in the cost of fixing the overall financial system, or at least that. So it's a little frustrating, at least for me personally, to kind of go, wow, this is a big-ticket item kind of on the backside. It would have felt better at least been coupled with CityEdge and be able to say, even though I realize there's distinct different systems, it's a kind of a big price tag item. But, you know, I'll leave that comment at itself. This does have a big price tag, and I don't know if you were going to get to it, but a $6 million price tag over 6 years.
No.
And there's,
mm-hmm. No.
Well, it's $976,000 a year.
Hold on. Two things. Mm-hmm. Council, we made it very clear. When we went out for the RFP, we did say we were looking for a tax system. But when we came back and gave you the price for CityEdge, we were very – we at that time realized it was not going to include this tax system. So I don't want to feel anybody feels like they're in the back room of a car dealership, because it was known on the price tag from the very beginning. We made it very clear that the amount that we gave you for CityEdge did not include this system. That was a major issue for us.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd use the term very clear.
Well, if you go look, if you want to look at the PowerPoint,
we're all sitting here scratching our heads.
Well, let's go. We'll go pull the PowerPoint up. Yeah. In that conversation,
might have missed it.
We made that was an item that we put on that, because we said, listen, we're going to be able to do everything except for, because we did go out with the idea that we could make that happen. We'll be glad to review that presentation again, but we did realize we had kicked this issue down the road because we had not found a system that could comprehensively take the tax system. What we then found out is going to find best practices to the other cities in the area, that there seems to be a, as Alex refers to, a best in breed that is pretty common throughout the area, and that's what we've been researching. And what we've come to you is the life cycle cost for this tax system, which includes the actual purchasing of the software and the systems. And I think the initial cost of that is around $2 million.
$2.3.
And what we've then given to you is the life cycle cost that every system has that we spend today to continue to pay for the license fees and the operations. So that's an ongoing cost that's always included in any software system we buy.
Well, over 6 years, $976,000 a year.
Yeah, it'll be $2.3 million and then $400,000 a year. So that's $2.3 million will get us for the first 2 years. Then it's another $1.2 million, if my math is good, for the next 3 years. That gets us through 5 years. So 1.6, I guess, for 4 years, or for four additional. So a total of six would be 2.3 plus 1.6.
Okay. But you'll always have, I mean, CityEdge is the same thing. CityEdge has ongoing operating costs.
Let me ask you a base question. What other cities use CityEdge? Dunn Phoenix use CityEdge?
The cities, or I mean,
yeah, cities in the valley. I thought a couple of cities in the valley use CityEdge.
Pima County
is
implementing it. There's a few other cities.
Tucson. I mean, Phoenix uses another brand of enterprise.
But just CityEdge. Tucson uses CityEdge, and then I know like New York and L.A. and some other big cities use it. But Tucson was one. I'm sorry. Does Tucson, what do they use for their taxing their license. They have a
comparable. They're using the same system we're proposing.
Okay, so they have City Edge, plus they also have this software that you're asking us today to do. And they use those in conjunction.
Since 2008, they've been running the same system side by side.
All right.
And then
so there are other times and other places where you have City Edge plus this add-on.
It's typical. Okay. Typically, they're not bundled together,
right,
except in the very smallest of cities that can have very simple systems and requirements. None of the cities in the Valley have them bundled together.
Right. Okay. Councilmember Higgins.
Thanks, Mayor. Is there any, have you looked at like a cost, labor savings in the other departments now that's all like one-stop shopping, no forms that the fire department or the police department have to fill out?
We haven't yet, Mayor, Councilmember Higgins. We haven't yet because we're really not sure what efficiencies we're going to get out of that. I expect that we will see some efficiencies, but at this point in time, it's really undetermined. Some of the cities from the past experience have found that there's actually an increase at the beginning because of the learning time, but then they're seeing that there's some decreases as they go along. So we'll just have to see how that weathers in our area.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay. Let's go on to the next one.
Tim?
Sure. The current tax system is basically antiquated and it's reached its end of its useful life. We have explored different ways to fund the updated system, and the two areas that we looked at is either general fund, which we know that there's really no funding in the general fund for that, and what we're doing is we're going to propose adjusting the TPT fees to equalize the license fees, which will make us comparable with the other cities. Currently, right now, the city of Mesa charges a $30 license and application fee. So it's a one fee of $30. And then we have a $20 renewal fee, a $15 late license fee, and a $10 late renewal fee. If you take a look at the other fees across the cities, they're averaging anywhere from about $68 up to about $70. I think one of the cities is actually 50. So Glendale's at 50. So it raises anywhere from about 50 all the way up to about $70. And our proposal is to bring our TPT license up to the $70, which is pretty much an average out there. By doing so, we would have adequate funding then to...
It's pretty much an average, or it's pretty much where others are?
It's pretty much where everybody else is. We're looking at actually, we can go to the next slide if you want. Why don't we do that? You're up? Okay, good, thanks. What we're proposing is a $20 application fee and a $50 license fee, and then you'll see on that slide that Chandler is at 15, Glendale doesn't charge anything for their application fee, but it's 20, 12, 20, and 25. Across that way. And then as far as the license fee is concerned, you can see it's pretty much $50 all the way across. Tucson's at $45. So as far as the licensing fee, it would bring us real comparable with the other cities.
And the cities that are listed here, I think with the exception of Scottsdale, and if you accept Peoria for Scottsdale, are all using the same system we're proposing. So these are all currently using the system that we're looking at right now.
Yes.
Councilmember Higgins?
I have voiced a concern about these numbers in our committee meeting, but I'll share them with you now. And that is, the license fee, we're charging for them to collect sales tax. And we're treating people, I always say the grandmas, because they really are grandmas, out in Dobson Ranch, who for a one-day fundraiser have to get a TPT license. So they're going to spend $50 to get a sales license to sell their quilts two times a year. And Walmart or Birch Ford or anybody else is paying the same amount of money as they are, and it seems is it retro, whatever,
progressive
tax on the smaller producer sales collector. So I have a problem with that on this. So that's, I'm just throwing that out there. And we didn't do any outreach. Did we do any outreach? I think the chamber had talked about would be willing to put together workshops or outreach to the community to see what the feeling was. And I just wonder if we have time. Well, we have lots of time. But if we'd be interested in doing that, I'd like to see what the community has to say from the business community.
I'd like to make sure we know what we're getting here. I mean, I don't like the idea when you're saying increase as much as it looks like you're just trying to equalize what other cities are doing. The question is, what did they get for that, and what do our businesses get for that? If we're just looking to increase fees, that's a different story from what you're asking for. It sounds like is for the business to make an investment that not only betters our lives, because that's most of what this discussion has been on, is how are we going to make our life easier? The question I go back to is, how does it really help the businesses? I mean, we could just keep going with where we're going right now and just hire people and have businesses go to three different places. Mm-hmm. Question is it worth the investment to make it simpler and easier and better to do businesses and to do business in Mesa? Is that what you're proposing? Is that what you're saying? Is that why you want to equalize the fees? Because if it's simply to raise the revenue, I still haven't heard a compelling argument for that. What I have heard, what I think, and maybe it's the way it's been presented, is, listen, we think that right now we have a system that is not friendly. Although that's not what I've heard. I've really heard that it's not really good for us. I don't know that that's a great place to start if we want to increase fees. If there's a place that this one-stop shop will truly help businesses and enable them to do business easier, faster, simpler, quicker, then yeah, I can see where we could ask them to invest in that because they end up better off. Still haven't gotten to the point where I really see that.
Well, yeah, these guys represent the business, but I've talked to the other agencies that are using these, those seven other city valley agencies that are using this, and they have the same process to use regardless where they go to. So if they would go to Mesa and they have another business somewhere else, they would go online in seven other cities. In Mesa, they have to go through.
Okay. So what you're saying is that if by updating the software, we have gotten in the 21st century and we are providing a direct benefit to people who want to do business in Mesa, and you're thinking that this fee is worth that the benefit is worth the cost.
Excuse me, if I may, Mayor, too. Just to go along with what you're saying, our taxpayers are very frustrated with our antiquated system. They're very frustrated with the fact that they got to turn paper in. Right. They can't go online and look at anything. Everything has to be manual or asking questions. So the amount of paperwork that we get every single month, 24,000 returns on a month, the number of those that have errors just because we can't read them, we're not applying them correctly in the system, which is causing aggravation with our taxpayers. So they've got to contact the city then because we've done something wrong. We've taken our best guess or our best shot.
The system allows for the filing of these tax returns online also.
Absolutely. And then for the taxpayer, just
I don't think we brought that up.
Well, I think Alice tried to bring that at the beginning. So the question is this. For $40, you have a new business coming in.
Yes.
Correct.
For $40 more. For $40 more of your time, you wouldn't have to come in. You could do it all online. You wouldn't have to come downtown. And so that's how you have to evaluate it. And then each year after that, it's $30 more a year not to have to come down and go through the process manually and do that. So, you know, that's part of
We also talked about monthly. Are you just talking about the annual renewals?
We don't do it.
Or what about monthly?
Just the monthly reporting of the tax forms. The majority of our taxpayers have to turn in monthly returns with us.
I mean, is that handled by this system too?
Absolutely.
The
huge part of that is that it would all be done.
So we're saying that I wouldn't have to fill out a manual tax return and cut a check. I could do it online and somehow transmit through this system. My monthly tax return also.
Yes, absolutely. You'd have an online form that you could actually do it all online. It'd fill everything out so it'd all be readable. Everything would be correct. It won't let you submit an incorrect statement, meaning your numbers have to add up. You can put in the numbers, whatever numbers you put in, they've got to add up, and all the taxes are correct. So everything should be correct when you get all said and done. So you're not getting notices from the city saying you have a math error and now there's penalties and interest and we've got to go through all of that just because they've made a math error or we couldn't even read it.
Oh, right. Yeah, I wasn't.
Huge. It's a huge.
You didn't bring up that you could do your monthly submittals also.
Yes.
And we didn't hear that at the committee level either. So thank you for that beautiful
bit that's
of
a big,
information.
I'll tell you, that's a big difference to me than just the initial deal. Because I don't want to tell you how many sales tax returns I've prepared and submitted over the years. They're horrible to do that. So that to me is a huge benefit to any business, whether it be the granny or the big one, to be able to go online, submit it electronically, and have the surety that it's done right, and you can do it much easier. That's a big difference to me. Councilmember?
I just wanted to follow up. One thing that isn't reflected in the proposed fees, so we've left the impression, hey, we need to just get up where everybody else is our fire fee that I don't think any other city in the valley has, is 15 to 300 to, you know, some pretty high numbers. That's an additional fee that businesses, you know, paying here. So the alarm fees, I don't know how that works for other cities too, but when you take, you know, you're looking at three different sets of fees, and we've kind of heard the TPT approach to things, and it does have an impact on the other fees. So business comes in and looks at it and says, hey, where am I impacted? How do I put this out? And just trying to, from a committee level looking at this, there's so much more information that's come out, and a little, it feels like a little bit of a change in the information that we got at a committee level. No one's ever doubted that, you know, there's something that needs to be done. Maybe it had some doubts about how we want to fund it or how we want to take it through. But again, that, you know, having, we haven't heard from the chamber. We've asked several times and looking forward to getting some information. I almost thought that silence was a little deafening. This, in these business times, these difficult times, you know, asking business to do much more when they're just trying to keep their heads above water is a challenge. So anyway, just offering a perspective from a committee person level.
Okay, so just to summarize real quick, because we're running out of time here, what you're proposing is to equalize the fees with other cities. For that, what the taxpayer will get is a new system that will consolidate, will eliminate the need to go to different stops and to fill out manual forms.
Correct.
They can do that online. They can do it on a one-stop shop in the initial application and in the renewal also. And then the second thing is that on a monthly basis, they can file their sales tax reports monthly online and do all that online without having to fill out and sign and send in manually a sales tax
Absolutely.
Report. And that's what they can get.
Yes.
Okay. And for that, what you're proposing is that we increase the fees to an area that from your table is comparable to what other cities do, but you believe that the benefit to the taxpayers, and there's benefit to the city also, but mainly the benefit to the taxpayer, in your opinion, is worth that.
Yes, Mayor, and I think to the taxpayer even more so than the city. I think it's going to save the taxpayer so much time and have far more accurate returns turned in, so far less interaction with the city as far as incorrect returns and penalties and interest that are being applied incorrectly because we can't read the forms or we're not getting the forms.
And basically on an annualized basis, that's $30 a year is what they'd be paying for this, because you're proposing going from a $20 renewal up to a $50 renewal. So the initial would be higher, $40 higher, and then the annual renewal would be $30 or $250 a month.
Correct.
No.
That renewal is annual, right?
It's annual.
Annual.
So you'd go from $20 to $50, $30 over 12 months is $250.
Right. Oh, you're right. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Vice Mayor.
I wonder if we can't get to slide 11.
Sure.
Within the context, we're talking about on slide 10, increasing the fees. The amount of revenue that would bring in is about just shy of $1 million. We'll just round it up to $1 million. Slide 11 then, however, says that by changing to this new system, if I'm reading the slide correctly, we would see an increased revenue of that $967,000. Now, is that the $1 million from that previous slide?
That's the difference between the 1.66633 million and the $666,000 that we're collecting today.
Okay. And then the cost of the annual maintenance is $400,000. So we're more than double. If we were just trying to pay for the system, we're more than double. And then I guess the other question I would have too is how much more revenue do we anticipate bringing in with the new system? What I'm trying to do is figure out, we're going to bring in more revenue by going to the new system. We're going to incur some more costs here, estimated at $400,000. So if we were going to increase the fees to kind of what the mayor's point was, is how do these fees benefit directly the folks who are using the system, so the businesses, and do we need to raise... Is there really a need to equalize the fees to what everybody else has had just to implement this system? That was a little convoluted in my discussion, okay. But I hope you got the gist.
If I may, one of the things that we added from the committee that they wanted to see is if we go with the full $70 fee, what will that do as far as the general fund? How long will the general fund have to fund this, and how soon will the general fund be made whole? And then what does our revenue look like year after that? So on slide 12, I've got that all pushed out. If you take the costs for the first 2 years, the revenue that we'll be getting in is $967,000. The cost for that first year is $1.2 million. That leaves us with $234,000 deficit that the general fund is going to have to fund the first year. Second year, we got $1,071,000 cost, $967,000 revenue, so another $104,000 drain on the general fund. So now we're at $339,000 from the general fund. Then you'll see in year three, we make sufficient income, and now we're back to plus. So the general fund has been made whole, and then we've got revenue from 3, 4, and 5 coming in to support any future
needs. And in year six, do you anticipate another capital expenditure to, didn't I hear something about the sixth year or something like that?
It's potential. There's a six-year lifespan on this, so it depends on how long this is
going
to go.
That cumulative cash flow, that's not money in the bank. What you're saying is that in year six or seven, there may need to be another significant capital expenditure to upgrade or do whatever.
There would be an upgrade. The cost that we really couldn't estimate at this time.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is these seem like they're dedicated, and I use that term loosely, but they're targeted, raising this so we can buy and maintain the system.
Yes.
Okay. But you show after the first 2 years a pretty significant positive cash flow. My question is, does that continue to increase, or is there a point in time where there's going to be another withdrawal from the bank, so to speak, that takes that down to where this really is a self-sustaining fee? We're not looking at this, hey, convoluted to convoluted.
Yeah, no.
I hope we're not looking for this as an addition to our general fund.
Right.
If we're looking at this purely to be self-sustaining and to continue to fund this software, which if we believe is a benefit, is a significant benefit to the businesses and taxpayers, and that's one thing. But it leaves the impression by your graph, and I don't know if that's the impression you leave, that, hey, after we get through the first couple of years, wow, this is a windfall. And I don't think that's what you're meaning to say.
Mayor, it is not. No, we're looking at this to being a self-sufficient type system. So if we get something at 6, 7, or 8 that needs to have an upgrade or so forth, there should be funding.
You're anticipating there will be an upgrade in those years, and that $1.3 million will be drawn down.
That's okay. Our impression.
Councilman Richens.
How much does the current system cost us per year compared to this? $400,000 per year. How much does it cost us now to maintain what we have?
License fees are minimal at staff time right now.
So explain to count, this is an in-house system.
This is an in-house system, so there's licensing for the software that it runs on. It's not in the $400,000 range.
Well, the other things you don't have the cost of paper to send out 24,000 or 23,000 tax bills. The postage to send that out on a monthly basis. That doesn't include all those or the personnel that's needed to process those.
So I think the council is asking is what is the ongoing operation cost of the current system? And we can go back and figure out. The difference is we're purchasing this outside the city, whereas the current system is maintained and operated in-house. It was an in-house built system.
It's an in-house built system built 18
years
ago.
So we've kind of got that cost embedded in our operations. So
staff, paper, and
yeah, and the difficulty
we won't have to do that with this system. It's going to be all electronic to the businesses. Are they going to get paper bills? Or are they going to get?
No, there'll be some, but it'll be greatly reduced. So,
could you opt in or opt out? I guess
that's what I'm thinking. And it's probably going to take some time to get everybody on board with this.
So some people just are going to need to have
paper.
That paper.
They're going
to
stay paper.
Other people would not. So there are potential savings, though, if you even cut that in half.
Right.
You're not mailing out 10 to 12,000 tax bills a month. You're not paying for the paper. You're not doing that,
right.
Which could add up.
Just to be clear, so the cost of the software and any new hardware associated with running this system is $2.3 million?
Yes, and the cost to implement the system, the vendor time to come and implement
it. It's $2.3 million.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, and there's no, like, in years 3, 4, and 5, you have $400,000 in costs embedded, but you don't need to embed $400,000 in operating costs in year 2 right after it's implemented or anything?
No,
that's the life cycle cost for 5 years. The run, implement, maintain, and run the system. And as we said, building the reserve up for potentially years 6 and 7 to replace or upgrade the system as it would be outdated.
$2.3 million will get us through the full first 2 years.
For hardware and software.
And
services.
All the services that are associated with
and
that.
And then the anticipated cost. So in year 3, what would be the contract coming for $400,000? What would be the expense?
It would be license maintenance. When you buy commercial software, you pay license maintenance, which is right-to-use licensing.
Fees, yeah.
And then any hardware maintenance or upgrades, we would need capacity or things like that. So we program in some miscellaneous costs on the hardware side. So it's
what is the licensing cost for year 3 in that? Just the licensing costs, assuming we didn't need any hardware.
If I remember correctly, it's between $230,000 and $240,000.
So over 50% of this expense is just the license fees to continue to use it.
Yes. Correct.
Okay.
Councilmember Higgins, and we need
really
to wrap
quick.
It up.
And why don't we want to go out to the business community just to see? Was this great?
Oh, we didn't say we didn't.
Okay. We're still
trying to get the information. I think the fact is we probably need to, but I'm not sure that, well, from the end of the discussion where we really got into the benefits to the individual business, I wasn't getting that in the first part, and I know that Councilmember Fenter didn't get it in the committee meeting. Maybe they have a better view as to what this actually means to them. You know, unfortunately, this thing started out as we want to raise fees so we can buy new software. And I know that's oversimplifying it, but when you get down to it, I can see the headlines and what people are going to understand. Oh, they want to raise fees. If it sounds like we're micromanaging, please understand that the phone calls we get are whenever we increase fees and do things like that, because it does affect the granny. It does affect the small business. And we're extremely cautious, and I want to make sure that $10 to us may not sound like a lot, but to a business owner who's struggling, that is a lot. And even if it's not a lot, it seems like a lot. And if they don't believe that there's real benefit and it will make their life better, then their belief is something that we should not charge them. So I think what you're hearing is we just want to make sure that the benefits that are derived are something that really do flow down to the businesses. I think that's right. So we've actually got to start another meeting in about 38 seconds. So we're not going to get anywhere, but I think that if you would maybe come back to us with some feedback from either the chamber or something else related to this additional expanded scenario that we have.
Sure.
I'd like to see, because my guess is if they really believe, and this is what's shown to be true quite often, if they believe there's a real benefit, then they can support this, because in the end, they win.
Sure.
They end up better. And if they don't, we'll certainly hear from that. But I think it needs to go through that process also, okay? So why don't you try that out and then come back to us, okay?
Sounds great. Thank you.
All right. Now, we're out of time for this meeting. We had an executive session that we really needed to go on. Do you want to add that on to the Thursday? Or?
So we're going to put it on later.
Yeah, that's fine.
Or do you want to delay the start of the...
No, that's fine. I think we're...
Are you okay? Okay,
to
wait until Thursday?
Okay. Thursday. Thursday.
Sorry about that.
Sorry.
Thanks for coming anyway. There's staff. Okay. Unless there's something real important scheduling-wise you need to tell us, Mr. Brady?
We're at Fiesta Mall for City Hall at the Mall this Saturday from 10 to 2.
Okay. I have a motion to adjourn from Councilmember Higgins, a second from Councilmember Fenter. All in favor say aye. No. Well, we'll do that tonight. We do that in the regular meeting. They can speak. Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? We're adjourned here, but we'll be upstairs 1 minute ago.